Welcome to The Rubric. I'm your host, Joe Andrew.
I'm Erica Connell.
And I'm Eric Hsu.
Today on the show, we talk with the editors of DID Web about this innovative DID method. Ori Steele, CTO at Transmute, and Oliver Turbu, tech lead at Spruce Systems Incorporated. This is part two of our two-part interview with Ori Steele and Oliver Turbu about DID Web. Part one can be found at rubric.cc.
Part of building simple and usable software and standards is keeping them short.
On the Rubric, we talk to folks making decentralized identity happen. We chat about the technologies and motivations behind decentralized identifiers, including DIDs, DID documents, and DID methods, so our listeners can make better decisions about which DID method is appropriate for their use.
Decentralized identifiers enable robust identity-based services without dependence on a trusted third party. So instead of being forced to use centralized identity verification services like Facebook, Google, or the Department of Motor Vehicles, DIDs can be created by anyone, anywhere, and be used for any purpose.
DID methods are the magic ingredient that give DIDs their flexibility. Before creating any specific DID, you first choose a DID method, which determines how you perform the create, read, update, and deactivate operations on a DID of that method. Once created, each DID includes the name of its method in the identifier itself, so that when you use the DID, others know how to retrieve the associated DID document that contains the cryptographic material for secure interactions.
Different DID methods use different underlying mechanisms with different performance, security, and privacy trade-offs.
This show, The Rubric, reviews different DID methods with their creators and implementers, so you can make better decisions about when and how to use DIDs in your applications.
Ori Steele is the CTO and co-founder at Transmute, where he leads all architecture, design, and execution for the Transmute platform. Ori has an MS in computer science and a BS in cybersecurity from Stevens Institute of Technology. He is an author of the W3C Decentralized Identifiers DIDs version 1.0 specification and an editor of the W3C Verifiable Credentials Data Model. Ori has managed security concerns for startups and publicly traded companies. He has built secure web applications in finance, energy, and healthcare. Ori, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oliver Turbu is tech lead at Spruce Systems Incorporated. He has been working in the digital identity space for about a decade and was involved as chair, lead editor, author, and contributor in various organizations such as ISO, CEN/CENELEC, W3C, DIF, and OIDF. Before joining Spruce, Mr. Turbu joined Walt.ID's advisory board, was head of architecture at Consensus Mesh Identity, and standards lead and solutions architect at Uport, part of Consensus SIS. At the Austrian State Printing Office, he worked as a solutions architect on mobile identity solutions for the public and private sectors, and became delegated expert into various identity-related ISO working groups. He also received the Austrian Standards Award in 2018. Oliver, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Here we continue the conversation.
Okay, now we're going to shift gears. What were some of the political, technical, or human challenges that you faced in developing DID Web?
I mean, there's definitely some challenges related to privacy. I think we already talked about that or touched that part of DID Web. This is because in order to resolve a DID Web requires sending an HTTP GET request to the server. So this means that every time a DID Web gets resolved, the server would actually know about the resolution process and could potentially track the IP address of the requester of the resolution request. This could be mitigated by having a trusted universal resolver service to achieve herd privacy. You can also use a VPN service or perform a resolution over the Tor network. There are some mitigation strategies, but there are obviously also some downsides in using DID Web.
Yeah, I think the privacy issues associated with the resolution request is the biggest one that folks immediately recognize in the method. The metadata issue, which we covered sort of briefly, is also a fairly large concern with DID Web, and it's unsolved, and it's a question of whether it will be solved in the future or whether it intentionally won't be. But just to sort of give some background on that particular problem, if you were to use a DID Web to execute, you know, a mortgage document today, in the future, you know, someone might be doing a title check on the property, and they might want to, you know, see your signature, and then they might want to ask the question of, okay, is this really from this person? And if the current DID document for that person didn't contain the key that they used to sign when they executed the mortgage document, it might look like, well, that's not a valid signature for them anymore. So this question of, was the key authoritative for that DID method at the moment in time where the signature occurred, is a problem in the DID method, you know, DID space generally, and it's often solved by being able to look up what were the keys in this DID document at this moment in time in the past, which is really easy to do if you've got all of the state transitions for that DID on a blockchain or any other immutable storage system where you've got all of the versions of history forever in one place. But for DID Web, you don't have that. Anybody can change the contents of the file at that path, and those keys will be added, those keys will be removed. And if you don't use a third party service to sort of witness those changes or attest to, you know, the authority, you know, the keys that were authoritative at this moment in time, it can create challenges. So I've hinted at like a couple different ways of thinking about the problem. Like you could kind of take the approach the blockchain based DID methods have taken, where they keep their own registry of changes for the identifier. You could rely on a third party service to, you know, give you a receipt that these keys were authoritative for my identifier at this moment in time. You could do other things with the DID document metadata that might expose that history of key material in some other way. But all of those things are sort of, they get very complicated very quickly. If you want folks to implement them consistently and you want interoperability, that can create a lot of challenge. So I think this is also an important aspect of DID Web that folks should be wary of, because depending on your use case, DID Web by itself might not be fully enough, especially if you're thinking about 30 year periods, like really, really long time periods. DID Web, you know, if you're rotating keys really, really frequently, DID Web might not be a great solution if you want really excellent auditability of every key that's ever been authoritative for that identifier.
I also want to add something to the privacy concern I mentioned earlier. I think the concern is less of an issue if you only use DID Web for issuers in their referral credentials, because then all the server actually can keep track of is who resolved the issuers or the server's DID, which is not really a problem. I think the problem with privacy only surfaces if you use DID Web for end users, because then the server can keep track of where the end users actually consume services. So my conclusion on that is actually, I think it's reasonable to use DID Web for issuers again, but for end users, it has certain privacy considerations.
It is common in corporate networks to strip off the TLS with an intentional man-in-the-middle architecture. Devices on the network are required to recognize the firewall as a legitimate root authority. You may have experienced this in a corporate network where your laptop or computer wasn't part of it and you can't reach any websites. But this allows the IT department to intercept and or modify network traffic, even over TLS. Does this mean that DID Web resolution on these types of networks can be arbitrarily rewritten by the IT department controlling the firewall?
I think the short answer to that is yes. So if you think about what is that, what are we really talking about there? It's the question of whether a corporation or a government has authority over the network that they maintain. And Yeah, they do. In some cases, they may have authority over huge regions of the network beyond just a local, you know, corporate network. They might control network. There, you know, if you think about the security architecture that the web relies on, there are regional institutions that maintain trust for large areas of geography. And what you're saying, that, you know, that particular kind of attack, you're most likely, or feature, it's, you know, it's weird whether you consider that to be an attack on the network, or is that really just the corporate IT department doing the right thing, right? Keeping an eye on all of the traffic, making sure folks aren't, you know, exfiltrating sensitive IP off of the corporate network. There are use cases within certain networks where you rely on, you know, surveillance technology like that as a defense strategy. And there are cases where some of these infrastructure components that go into DID web start to fail when you have certain categories of adversary. So it depends on your threat environment, whether this is going to be a really big problem or not. If you're accessing DID web documents on a corporate network for legitimate business purposes, and you trust your IT administrators to protect that network and not be compromised, then that activity might not be all that concerning. But you can imagine how an attacker might exploit that natural defensive strategy that corporate IT folks had implemented, and the attacker gets in there and they're injecting key material and they're playing other games. What looked like a defensive strategy has now been exploited as an offensive attack strategy. And you see that a lot in systems that attempt to attack end-to-end encryption just broadly, generally, right? So there are folks out there who really want the ability to see or interact with encrypted traffic because they have, you know, either a corporate oversight responsibility, law enforcement responsibility, or that's just the security, you know, posture that particular organization has. And it's a dangerous thing because it can be exploited by the attacker, but it's also potentially a required capability depending on the regulatory framework that you're in and, you know, particular governance strategy of the corporation that you're, you know, a member of. It's a great, really an excellent question. And I think it speaks to the limitations of the web as a security infrastructure that you're building on just generally. And so there are mitigation strategies for some of those things. Like you could attempt to sign the content, you know, on the original web server. And then if there was tampering, you know, in line, you would be able to detect it. But then there's other issues with that. Like, how do you know to trust this key that this content was signed with? It sort of creates a turtles problem, which you might think, well, that's really well solved by other DID methods. Maybe DID web just slowly goes away and it becomes a bridging technology to more decentralized methods where you can discover the key material and it's providing some confidence and defense against attacks on TLS. I think that it starts to get very complex again. And so I would be concerned that as you try and patch over the inherent limitations in TLS and DNS, and the, as you mentioned, like current corporate IT, you know, firewall security patterns, if you start trying to make DID web resilient to some of those things, the trade-off could be that you lose adoption of the technology to add a small epsilon of security to it. Or maybe, you know, you disagree and it's a larger than an epsilon of security that you're adding, but still there's complexity that comes with that trade-off. So yeah, it's really a great question. And I think as folks implement DID web, they will hit this point and then they'll ask, am I concerned about that use case? And often I'll interact with someone on issues and they'll say, you know, my threat model is I'm trying to defend against nation states. And I will say, ooh, not sure you want to be using DidWeb for that. There are cases where maybe DidWeb isn't the right solution. And to some extent, trying to circumvent your corporate IT policy, it might be that what you're doing there with DidWeb might not fit perfectly well with what DidWeb was created to do.
I fully agree with what Ori just said, and I also want to add that so what software is typically installed on employees' devices or employees' computers or laptops? So typically in a company that does SSL breakup or TLS breakup, I mean, employees, they use corporate software, but they might also use consumer software. The corporate is not really interested in providing wrong data to their own software. So it makes no sense for the corporate. So there's no reason to be concerned about that use, about that threat. The other thing is when employees run their own software on their laptops within the corporate IT or network, then they could be affected by SSL breakup, TLS breakup. But then, in my opinion, it would still be possible that this software, this type of software, would still be able to detect that the TLS certificate is not the right one. It's basically like the TLS certificate that the IT security officer installed, which is typically not installed in consumer software. You need to, you know, trust that certificate. And if the end user is not doing that intentionally, then that software might fail retrieving the DID web. So it won't work perfectly because the TLS connection cannot be verified, but at least the software would not get the wrong result from the resolver.
That is a great workaround and feeds into my next question. I mean, you basically said the software itself that might be running on this desktop that might be in a corporate environment doesn't have to rely on the default DNS configuration of the IT department. So it doesn't have to accept the man in the middle root authority as valid. And so that is an interesting architectural shift. The assumption is that the software will defer to the operating system's authority architecture. And so you check out, you know, I don't think it's Etsy host, but it's like Etsy host, right? You defer to the policy that your device has, and the software doesn't have to do that. So the general question is, so DIDs basically were designed to provide end-to-end verification or trust relationships, right? So if you have this key and it is actually protected, you have privacy around the secret material, then you can have end-to-end encryption or end-to-end verification that, yes, that person really did sign this. And some of these attacks that we've been talking about mean the man in the middle could interject in that. Are there other mechanisms where we can address that risk in the way that, Oliver, you just pointed out? Like, I thought that was great, that your software doesn't have to rely on the current network's architecture. Are there some other ways to improve end-to-end verification with DidWeb?
Well, I think I mentioned before, you know, you can sign the DidWeb document. And then, of course, you have to have everyone agree to verify that DidWeb document according to whatever mechanism you've used to sign it. And depending on which, you know, key material you've used that, you know, for that, it can, like, maybe there's some value that can be provided from signing the DID document or aspects of the DID document metadata. That's definitely one.
Another option might be, which might not be super feasible, is to anchor the DID web DID documents in an aggregated way on some decentralized ledger. So you can then verify based on a DID document result that a particular DID web was registered on a ledger, if this makes sense. But again, so in practice, this might not be feasible, especially because DID web was invented for people who are maybe more reserved and hesitant in implementing decentralized ledger technology. Yeah, but there are ways like that where we have.
Yeah, I think I would, when you're thinking about why do I trust this key as authoritative for this issuer, I would like for that problem to be solved for DID web using a generic building block that would be relevant to other DID methods and not to be sort of solved by injecting deeper complexity into the DID web method itself. So I think that it's important to negotiate where does the DID method layer end and the supporting software that goes along with it begin. So what about the trusted resolver layer? What about endorsements for verifiable credentials and endorsements for issuers and systems that manage endorsements and those kinds of other systems that you have? And like you also mentioned, you know, what about the device and the installed certificates and other material that might be preloaded into the device, either at the operating system level or even deeper, you know, firmware layer. So it's not the DID method and interaction with a specific identifier isn't happening in a vacuum. There's layers before it and layers that come after it. And sometimes you get a better property by handling these things at a different layer than in the DID method implementation itself.
In our earlier chat, you mentioned simplicity as a design pattern. And I think also earlier in this podcast, can you speak to what you meant by that? Tell us a little bit more about it.
Sure. So the software or the standard, let's start with the standard. First, the standard should be short, should be easy to read so that you're not getting lost in the details between page, you know, 57 and page 214. Now there's, if it's that long, there's a lot of chance for, you know, weird discrepancies to pop up. So part of building simple and usable software and standards is keeping them short. And that means that you don't have a lot of, you know, wiggle room. When you talk about what does it take to create an identifier, you've got only so much space to do that in. And so today, DID web has some fairly loose requirements in terms of what a DID controller needs to do to create a new identifier for a subject. And the controller could be the subject or they could be separate entities, right? If we start to expand all of the things that you need to do to safely support an operation, the method itself could become more complicated when you read the specification. But also the implementations of the specification can get really complicated because two different implementers could read the same paragraph and come to different implementation choices, and they might be consistent. But if that paragraph becomes a couple pages long, the chances of them disagreeing on something sort of fundamental go up. And then further from that, you know, the risk in an implementation difference that is like actually exploitable. So like we're concerned about those kinds of cases when we build the method specification, because the method specification is going to guide the implementations, and differences in the implementation are ultimately going to be what will lead to interoperability or vulnerabilities that are exploitable in a particular implementation, and those kinds of considerations. So today, I think DID web is really biased towards being very, very simple and not having a lot of complexity where you might get tangled up in an implementation difference. But I suspect as it you know, matures and becomes and moves towards standardization, there will be additional complexity that has to be addressed to remove ambiguity and uncertainty and to give it some, you know, sort of future safety and upgradability and some of these other extensibility, you know, features that you want in a longer lived specification. So I think it's good that it's simple now because it's only going to get more complicated from here. And as a, you know, an editor and a contributor to it, my bias is to try and keep it simple and look at what are the features that are being asked for. Is there a simple way to afford them? Is there a better solution for, you know, this person? They have a feature, they have a use case, But maybe a trusted resolver is actually the thing that they're looking for, not a change to our method specification. Or maybe they want another system for getting a trusted list of issuers instead of having the method specification itself embed that kind of information. So it's a managing complexity is a difficult thing. And oftentimes you need to have some other sort of categories of, or places where you might be able to put a couple of puzzle pieces together to give that same kind of feature without making the method specification more complicated. And I consider it to be, as a method author, it's sort of part of my job is keeping the specification as simple as possible, so it's as easy to implement as possible. And so the chance of critical security issues in implementations is as low as possible.
Yeah, that's a great answer. When I first heard you say that in our pre-call, my thought was the web is already so complicated. I thought you were suggesting something else, but that was a great example of how valuable it is to have simplicity. Because it goes through not just the spec, right, but to people's ability to implement the spec, which is a much wider audience.
If a DID web resolution query returns a 404 not found, how is the resolving party to interpret that?
So that's a great question. And for future listeners, go read the method specification because it could change. So what I'm about to say might not be the right answer several years from now. But essentially, the important feature of DID resolution is that the identifier that you get in the DID document match the identifier that you put in to resolve. And so if you get a document that doesn't have that identifier, resolution has failed. There are many different ways of interpreting different kinds of resolution failure. For DID web, I would say the 404 status code is already, indicating that this is an unresolvable identifier that you've requested. But the point I'm making about the ID property and the DID document is important because you might ask, what's the simplest resolvable DID web? And it's really a JSON object that just has an ID that matches the DID web. So it doesn't need anything else. That's a valid JSON DID document, just an ID. It's not a very useful DID document, but it's very, very simple at its most basic layer.
So doesn't this mean that a deactivated DID document is indistinguishable from a DID that was never created with DID web?
Yeah. And it's sort of also sort of tied into that question about it's related to the timing and metadata issue for different states of updates to a DID web. So you might ask how many updates has this DID web ever had? You won't know the answer to that by just looking at the DID web specification. And you also won't know if it's unavailable today, was it ever available? And just on the point of deactivation, there are some DID methods where deactivation is permanent, terminal thing for the identifier, and others where a DID can become deactivated and then become reactivated again. And so what about DID web? Like how should DID web behave with respect to that property? And the DID web specification should describe how you should interpret, these kinds of considerations. I think to answer your question sort of as directly as I can today, I think a deactivated DID web and an unresolvable DID web are indistinguishable from each other.
And are you aware that makes it not conformant with the DID spec?
I'm not sure it makes it not conformant with the DID spec, but I'm happy to hear the argument in greater detail.
Sure. The quote is, if a DID has been deactivated, DID document metadata must include this property with a Boolean value true.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to distinguish between a DID that was never created and it's just not resolving, and a DID that did once exist, but has now been explicitly deactivated.
Yeah.
Which I think we could evolve, but I think right now we're not quite compliant.
Yeah, and I should also mention that the whole concept of DID document metadata is generally not handled well with respect to interoperability. So the entire category of that document is optional, as I understand it. So a mandatory field and an optional object is, what does that mean? You know, it's hard. I think the one DID method, the family of DID methods I have the most experience with that comes with deactivations that are built into it is the Sidetree family of DID methods. And they do return that deactivated flag. And I don't know how you would ever create that kind of flag in DID web without starting to store a consistent version history for a given endpoint. Actually, for every possible given endpoint, a unique version history of all state changes associated with that URL forever. That's an expensive proposition. I would gather that DID web is probably not super likely to implement that particular pattern. And it should be noted that deactivation is not a required to implement operation. So you could say that it's impossible to deactivate a DID web. And it's kind of a way of getting around it, because DID key, for example, you can't deactivate a DID key. So there's a couple different ways of tackling that kind of problem. But that's a great example of the kind of thing that folks stub their toe on when they come to implement DID web, and they come back to the specification and they're like looking for the answer and they can't find it. That's a great time to open an issue and complain, get people into the issue and start to discuss the problem further, work forward towards the point where you can open a pull request. And then once the pull request is merged, the draft moves forward. But remember, it's a draft, and when that draft goes to a formal standards body, they can take all of your decisions and just erase all of them. So there isn't really stability around what DID web is until it's a permanent standard, you know, with a version number that's never going to change. And so even if there's a solution to this tomorrow, it may not be the solution that a working group would agree to several years from now.
Yeah, fully agree with what Ori just said. And also keep in mind that DID web has been around for a while and was invented or developed before DID core became final. And DID core became final only recently. So there's room for improvement. And as Ori mentioned, just go to the GitHub or join CCG first, go to the GitHub, create issues, create PRs. That would be really great.
The DID web spec does require TLS, but not DNSSEC. Could you unpack why that particular distinction? Why not also require DNSSEC?
Yeah, it's what the spec says today. It's a community group draft. I think there's complexity in DNSSEC that is painful. And one of the things that I like about DID web is you can kind of, if you trust a service provider, you can use DID web and let the service provider manage your Let's Encrypt certificate and your DNS level security. So for example, like GitHub, if you want to use GitHub Pages to host a DID web document, you can trust GitHub to handle 100% of that for you, and you're fine. You just change the file in the Git repo and you get actually a really awesome version history for every change you've ever made. And everything works. If you start to require every implementer of DID web to conform to DNSSEC, you would lose off-the-shelf CMS support in certain categories of service provider. So that's one of those sort of cases where I think there's trade-offs there, and you're looking for what's going to make this method, you know, highly usable, and Are the security trade-offs that I'm making for usability, you know, worth it in terms of adoption, or have I missed something sort of critical? Is DNSSEC a feature that should be turned on and mandatory, and it's okay to lose support for certain kinds of service providers that can't support it? So I think again, it's a question of where the community wants to draw that line in the method specification.
Okay, so to move into our resolution, what is next for DID web?
So we'll certainly continue to review issues and pull requests. I think there are certain sets of guidance that probably doesn't belong in the method specification, but that would be very helpful to implementers. And there might need to be an implementation guide that's paired with it, or another place to sort of get into some of these more technical details, or security trade-offs. So there's a couple examples of that. Like the DNSSEC question is a good example of that. Like, what if I really want DNSSEC? How do I do that well with DidWeb? Another one is, what if I really want X509 and certificate chains? How do I do certificate chains well with DidWeb? Maybe I've got, a software signing use case where I really want a certificate chain to be exposed in my DidWeb document. So those kinds of, things, maybe they don't belong in the DidWeb spec itself, but they belong sort of paired with it. There's a lot of interest in those kinds of issues. And then there are issues in the specification itself, like addressing the deactivated issue, like discussing the sort of history or provenance for a given identifier, those kinds of considerations. And then I think, the biggest sort of major checkpoint that everyone should be keeping their eye on for DidWeb is, when does it become an internet standard? And where does it become an internet standard? Does it go to the W3C? Does it go to IETF? Does it go, to another standards organization to be standardized? What's the right home for DidWeb? What's the journey that it takes to get to that place, and how long, and how many years, et cetera? So I think it's important to remember that it's still being developed. It's gaining traction. It's very easy to use, but it's the last pages of DidWeb aren't written yet, and so we don't really know exactly what's next for it. But that's a sort of smorgasbord of different possible paths that it might take from where it is today.
Is there any hopeful timeline for that first version, or is that still too early in the process? Hopefully, in the future.
If it goes to W3C, many, many years. So I'm not sure. It feels like W3C would be a natural place to do it. And in fact, there's already been discussion about the next version of decentralized identifiers, and will the working group standardize a set of methods as part of the next working group formation? And this is clearly a DID method that's on the top of everyone's mind when it comes to that kind of thing. But I'm not sure what the timeline would be for that. I think it's years out.
How can our listeners get involved?
I believe they should join W3C Credentials Community Group. It's free, it's open source, and then they should participate in the DidWeb GitHub discussions by talking about issues in the issues, creating new issues, or raising PRs to address certain issues after they reach consensus.
Perfect. Thank you.
I agree with Oliver.
As we move to wrapping up, we like to ask all of our guests, other than the DID method we're talking about today, DidWeb, what's your favorite DID method?
DID PKH.
PKH?
Because it can represent any blockchain account, the blockchain agnostic representation of blockchain accounts. So you can essentially represent Ethereum accounts, even Bitcoin accounts, Solana accounts, or whatever accounts as it did. That's why I like it. It's very similar to DidKey, but for blockchain accounts.
Yep, that's a good one. I like DidKey. I like DidJWK, which is like DidKey, but it's sort of more focused on JSON web key representations and the IANA registry. It has a slightly different set of dependencies that you need to implement it. That's a cool one. I think, like I said this before, and I really strongly believe this, but diversity is a security characteristic. I think if you look at this, so many different DID methods, some of them are going to be fairly similar, and it's going to be hard to tell which one has better security characteristics. But within this, sort of large field of different DID methods, there are ones that have these interesting properties. And those properties could be inspirational, and you might take a series of those properties from several different DID methods and you might create your own, a new one. And I think it's important to consider that your favorite DID method might not be invented yet. You might be the one that's going to invent it. You can go to the registry, you can look at all of these different DID methods, pick the traits that you're looking for, combine them and make a new method, write a method specification, open a pull request to register it. And there'll be one more DID method and everyone can insert their obligatory reference to the XKCD comic about how we get, you know, one more standard. But I think that that's an okay thing for DIDs for where they are today. And I think we should embrace diversity and we should sort of explore the space before we start to get, you know, really particular about, you know, which DID method is the best DID method, you know, which one should I use for everything. I don't think we should be using one DID method for everything. I don't think that's ever going to be good advice.
Now we'd like to take a moment for our shameless plug segment. Oliver, I think you have one for us. Is that right?
Yeah, I think I have at least one. I think it was interesting that Ori mentioned DID traits. So at Sprues, we recently published a blog article, which is about DID method traits. And we're also going to attend a Rebooting of Trust in The Hague, where we're going to host a session on DID methods traits, which is complementary to the DID rubrics work.
Wow, cool. I'm going to shamelessly plug our DID directory service, which is the easiest way to find the details on any W3C registered DID method. You simply go to diddirectory.com/method name for details, and including links to the official method specification. For example, for DID web, visit diddirectory.com/web. That's diddirectory.com/web.
And I'm going to give a shout out to our DID evaluation service at diddevaluations.com, where we post DID method rubric evaluations of various methods, one of which happens to be DID web. And I'd also like to give a big shout out to Ori, our guest, for helping out with that evaluation. So if you want to learn more about DID web, go take a look at diddevaluations.com.
Awesome.
And that will bring us to the end of our... Oh, Ori,
one more,
yes.
One more.
Yes, please.
You know, shameless plugs, they've got to be off the cuff, right? So I want to give a shameless plug for the traceability work happening at the W3C CCG. So this is work on applying decentralized identifiers and verifiable credentials to issues involving global supply chains. So if you're interested in securing supply chains for oil and gas, for agriculture, for steel, or for e-commerce, or if you've got a use case that isn't one of those, the traceability work happening at the W3C CCG is a great place to look at how to build credentials, verifiable credentials for a given use case and how to use decentralized identifiers to secure them.
Awesome. Thank you. And that will bring us to the end of our show today.
Ori, thank you for joining us on the show today. Oliver, thank you. Thanks also to our staff, our producer, Eric O'Connell, and my co-host, Eric Hsu. I'm your host, Joe Andrew.
Wherever you find the Rubrik podcast, please take a moment to subscribe to our feed so you'll be notified when our next episode is released. We look forward to you joining us next time. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed by the speakers in this podcast belong solely to the speakers, and not necessarily to the speaker's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual.